This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person who has an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a dangerous asshole, like driving 90 miles an hour in the 50 zone. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. So here's something you're not supposed to say. My guest this week is a whore. That's what she calls herself, and for very important reasons. In fact, as you'll find out, Maggie McNeil changed history recently when she said very publicly what you're really not supposed to say. Maggie is the author of the blog The Honest Courtesan, which has become a hub for the emergent sex worker rights movement. She's also written articles for Reason, The Washington Post, and Cato Unbound. I interviewed Maggie in Portland, Oregon, right in the neighborhood that was originally the city's red light district. That was a place where women, just like Maggie, proudly called themselves the worst name. So I'm here with Maggie McNeil, who I've known for about 6 years. I met her online, well, I guess through email, in 2010, I believe, maybe 2011. You sent me an email that I still have guilt about. It wasn't so much the email that I have guilt about. It's my horrible response to it, or really non-response to it. What happened was, well, you could tell the story, but I my book came out in 2010, mm-hmm. and it had a chapter in it.
On whores.
That you particularly liked.
Yes.
And you reached out to me, right?
Yeah, I did.
You wanted me to do something.
I was asking if you would consent to do an interview.
Right.
And now you're interviewing me.
And you had what was it? Was it a podcast?
No. Just for my website.
Oh, for the blog.
My blog. Yeah, it was going to be a print.
I see.
A print interview. Uh-huh.
And I just totally blew you off.
I didn't get the sense that you totally blew me off. I got the sense that you said, yeah, let's do it. And then you got really, really busy.
Yeah.
And you were, let's face it, I was kind of a small fish at the time.
I wasn't such a dick about it, but yeah, I still, anyway. So yeah, I
you blew me off nicely.
I was doing a bunch of publicity, of course,
yeah.
for the book. And I was really busy then. I'm trying to give all the excuses now, but it's true. And yeah, you were the small fish. And so I kind of had to,
I had to
let you go.
Honey, that this is, I am a whore. I understand this.
Well, that's the thing, though. So you were the only,
I get this.
But you were the only actual renegade who wanted to interview me, and yet I still blew you off. So I just feel like shit about it still to this day.
And I forgive you.
I do. And then it turns out that Maggie McNeil, it turns out to be the best and most important intellectual and activist in the sex worker community in the United States of America. So then I was like, oh, well, now it's time to come back with my tail between my legs and beg her. Then that's when it turned. Beg her to do things with me. And so we did, and we've done a few things together.
We have.
Made some videos and done some interviews, I think, and other stuff. And yeah, so you are, I'm going to say that again. I do think you're the best and most important intellectual and activist in that movement.
Well, I'm going to let you say that. I'm not going to say that. I'm not even going to agree with it, but I'm enjoying hearing you say it. So.
I bet you are. and this also, so that's 2010, this is now 2017. And in that period, I would say, you know better than I do, but it seems to me that the sex worker movement, sex worker rights movement, has really turned a corner in that time.
And I absolutely agree.
Become bigger and more prominent, and
absolutely
people
agree.
Are talking about it, and sort of that issue is now actually on the table. It's not as fully on the table as other issues like drugs, et cetera, but it's still there. And there's a mainstream presence now in the movement, which is amazing and new, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's I think it is social media. I think it is the prevalence of blogs, Twitter, things like this, where, you know, it used to be that if you didn't have, who was it that said once, freedom of the press is limited to those who own the press?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not so anymore, right? Mencken, I think it was Mencken.
Right. We all own the press now.
We all own the press. Mm-hmm. And so now you don't have to take the prohibitionist and the cops and the politicians' word for it. Oh, these whores are all downtrodden and they're all victims and blah, 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 because we're all on damn Twitter and you can follow as many of us as you like.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see us not just lecturing people, but just talking amongst ourselves and stuff, you know? Just last night on Twitter, I was just mucking around. I said some, and I had a client to go see, and I said something like, went to the beauty parlor earlier, did an interview, grabbing a sandwich now before I go make some money on my back. And you say things like this on Twitter, right? And the thing is, people understand and recognize that these things are honest, that they're sincere, that they're real. Even when we complain about clients or when we talk about this or that going wrong, they see that the real things that go wrong are like things that go wrong in any job or business, right? They're not these gigantic things you can base a movie on. It's not this sex trafficking and, you know, crazy pimps shooting people and all this kind of stupid stuff you see in movies, you know, or TV shows. It's the same things that, you know, can go wrong with any customer service type job, right?
It's a job. Yeah, it's a work. Job.
Yeah.
Hence the reason we now try to call it sex work.
Right.
Which we'll certainly get into, and it's very important. Terminology is very important.
Oh, I agree.
Gabe here, who's my audio person, was worried about what to call you when we got here.
He was worried about what to call me?
Kind of making that up a little bit. No, I've actually been, I've been worried at times because you guys, the sex workers who are prominent in social media, you know, are my heroes. And
thank you.
At the same time, I'm a little scared of you because for very good reason.
As you should be.
For very good reason, you are all very, very fierce against your opponents. And you're very fierce about things that matter. And you could be accused of being obsessed with words like social justice warriors are and politically correct people are. But in your case, it really is almost a matter of life and death, right?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Or at least it's a matter of whether you are free or in prison.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not just hurting feelings.
No.
In fact, it's not about hurting feelings for you guys. It is about, right, whether a society thinks of you as criminals or not.
Well, this is part of the whole hierarchy thing, isn't it? You see, I mean, because one form of sex work, right, full-service sex work, prostitution, you know, is the only one that's really illegal. And then you have other ones that are kind of para-illegal, or that I shouldn't say para-illegal, that's another word that means something different. I mean, quasi-legal, gray zone. And you go some things that are definitely legal. But so you see a lot of sex workers very vehemently trying to draw lines between themselves. Well, I'm not a prostitute. Well, I'm not, you know, because they, not only because of the stigma, but also because they want to keep themselves out of prison, right? You know, so it's like, if you can very clearly establish, no, I am not that thing that is criminalized. So the words do matter.
When was the interview in Seattle in the news when you came out?
That was
about a year ago, 2 years ago?
A little over a year ago.
Yeah.
That was January of, the actual raid was on Epiphany. It was on January 6th.
So there was, I didn't know there was a raid.
Yeah, the raid in the sense of that they went and arrested some, you know, some guys, and they did the take down the board and the all those ugly, you know, labels appeared on the board and
right. But a local news television station interviewed you.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And in that interview, you said, I think you were standing on the street, right? And you said, I think you said, I am Maggie McNeil and I am a prostitute.
Oh, that was the next day in the courthouse. And I guess that kind of made it, I guess that's what really shocked a lot of people, is that it was being recorded in a courthouse with about 10 cops within hearing distance. And the guy says, well, are you a prostitute? And I'm like, yes, I'm a prostitute.
It was one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen on television. And I think it was one of the most important things. Because, well, no, really, come on, think about it. I mean, that was certainly, isn't it the first time any person has done that? And outed themselves as a sex worker on television with their face being shown?
In American television?
I've never heard of that. Yeah.
It might be.
I think it is. And, you know, when I was just thinking about this today with gays and lesbians, Melissa Etheridge coming out was actually a really big deal.
Oh, yes, it was.
I think she was one of the very first celebrities, right, to come out. And it was a big, big deal. In some ways, it sort of opened the floodgates. And then it became almost trendy.
Yeah.
Eventually,
I mean,
to come out.
No, I can see it. And you're right. Yeah, because at one time, right, it was all tease and denial. I mean, it was, right. I mean, even if you, people that everybody knew were queer, you know, you just couldn't do that. You couldn't, I mean, Liberace sued somebody and won. Right, for implying, for not saying, but for implying, because the guy had used words like fruit flavored and things like that.
Sure.
And he won that case.
But it also, but it gave people, I think, a feeling of license that they could do this. They could now get away with it.
Yes.
They could. Now, in your case, there's a higher degree of risk for two reasons. One is cultural and social, and the other is legal, of course, right?
Right.
So, the only people who have been despised more than gays and lesbians historically are sex workers.
Yeah.
And we no longer have laws that make making homosexuality illegal in this country.
Right. So we're it now.
But you're it. So it was a major, you know, double jeopardy there. And so it was really heroic and it was amazing. And it was unprecedented. And I said at the time, I said I could feel history turn.
Yeah. I remember you said that. And as I said, my own blog a little later, and part of that, honestly, was that wasn't calculated on my part. That was pure obstinacy. I'm very stubborn. And basically when I have the way it happened was this reporter, from King 5 is the station, and they tend to be more kind of prohibitionist. They're more, you know, conservative. And he's like, well, are all these women here prostitutes? You know, all the ones that were protesting were there to, you know, for the news conference, right? And I go, well, we're all sex workers. And he goes, well, what are sex workers? And I said, well, sex workers are any type of person that sells their own erotic labor. That's so strippers, porn actresses, phone sex operators, prostitutes. He goes, so some are legal and some are illegal. And I said, that's correct. I said, and that's one of our quibbles, right, is that the state is drawing artificial distinctions between different kinds of sex work
or arbitrary distinctions, right?
Very arbitrary,
yeah.
Right? Because they do overlap. And he goes, and then he goes, well, are you a prostitute? And I remember my reaction. My reaction was like, you little weed. You know, it was like in my mind. And so I said, yes, I'm a prostitute. Because it was kind of like,
with your face on camera.
Yeah.
On television.
Yes.
I mean, that's really something.
Well, I said in on Twitter after, Ali, I got to ask y'all. You know? Yeah. I mean, it's, okay, we made that decision.
Now,
yeah,
I would imagine
Rubicon
you felt, I would imagine you felt partly liberated to do that because the sex worker movement started to become somewhat mainstream. Was that before the New York Times piece?
It was before the New York Times piece.
Was, wow,
by a few months. Yeah,
well,
by a few months.
Especially brave then. So the New York Times, a few months after this interview, this was last year?
Uh-huh.
New York Times, had, people may not know. Had
April or May.
A major feature in the magazine, right? The New York Times magazine on sex worker activists.
Yes.
Including, by the way, photos of about, 50 sex workers?
36, I think.
A lot of people, with their faces in the New York Times. And best of all, it was essentially a positive article.
Absolutely it was.
Yeah. That was a major turning point too, of course.
Oh yeah, I think so.
So, okay, let's back up to the words. You know, because in academia, of course, everybody's obsessed with words that insult people or offend people, even though they have no material, you know, meaning in the world.
I'm going to
no material effect
narrate here that I just rolled my eyes.
No, yeah. So, all right. So you prefer, well, it's interesting. It's funny with you. You prefer, as I understand it, you prefer the terms sex worker and whore.
Sex worker.
Those are the ones you use all the time.
I use sex worker when I'm being polite, right? And also when I'm being general, because sex worker is a general term. It does bring in all those different. And some people like to say, when they mean a prostitute, you know, a person who actually sells the actual physical act of sex, as opposed to like a stripper who sells a show, mm-hmm. you know. When some people like the term full service sex worker, and as a writer and as a former English major, I really don't like polysyllabic things like that.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a lot. And so I personally just like whore. But I will tell people, if you're speaking to someone that you do not know is okay with that, that is not a good thing to just throw out. You know, okay, how many whores are in here? You know, it's not a good idea. Sex worker is the polite term. And then if she doesn't mind, and I'm going to say she in this interview, because most of the sex workers I know are female, but of course there are male sex workers too. That's my laziness. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to default to she.
So whore, of course, originated as an epithet, right?
I guess.
I think it
just originally was not. I mean, I think originally it was just a word, right? I mean, it's an Anglo-Saxon word.
It's a good question, actually. I should know this as the historian here.
I think it's just an Anglo-Saxon
historian of
word.
Prostitution. I mean, it certainly became an epithet. So that by the time the sex worker rights movement came around in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, it was definitely an insult.
It was an epithet. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. And so I was wondering, I was always assuming that sex worker activists who used that term to describe themselves were doing the reappropriation thing.
Of course.
Right. As in,
nigger, I also call myself queer.
As in nigger and queer. Right.
Yes.
How, right.
Right. Reclaiming nigger, those right. things. Take, you know, Norma Jean O'Motivar, the veteran mm-hmm. sex worker
yeah,
rights activist, wrote a poem once, and the last couple of lines stick with me because it's a strong ending. It was, if I tell you that I don't care anymore that you call me a whore, what will you call me now?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's it, right?
You strip it of its power.
You strip it of its power. Yep. It's like, you know, and people will ask me, you know, what do you do for a living? And I'll go, I'm a whore.
Right.
And they'll be like, you're what? Why whom? You know, and because sometimes it's very funny. They'll think of it in the colloquial sense. And I've actually had people go, oh, yeah, well, I'm a whore, too. I'll go, no. I mean an actual prostitute.
Right.
As in an actually take money for sex. And then they'll be like,
Oh,
because they're thinking, I mean, a slut.
Right. You
know? And it's like, no, right. I mean, actual whore.
Yeah, no, it's really disarming. And it's very disarming, right? It takes away their power to sort of shame you.
Absolutely.
Too, right?
And that's one of the reasons that even though I personally dislike the word prostitute, and I dislike it because it's very legalistic.
Hmm.
I just don't like legalistic sounding things. I also don't like terms like police officer. You know what I'm saying? I just don't like legalistic sounding terms. Hmm. But I'll use it because it does disarm people. Because
right.
I'm saying, because, right, if I say whore, there is that kind of grayness. If I say prostitute, it's pretty much one thing.
Yeah, it's exactly what that means. That's what I am.
Yes.
That's what I do.
Yes.
So I understand. So the politics of the term sex worker, right, is fairly obvious. It's to put forward the idea that this is work like any other work.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And we'll get back to that in a second, that concept, which is still difficult for most people to accept, and which in my classes takes me many, many, many classes to get into the heads of my students, if I'm successful at all. Whore you like because it's a reappropriation, it disarms the word.
And right? It's also because it's just, I have a fondness myself, as a writer, and you've read my stuff, I either like these polysyllabic, you know, words that people have to look up, or else I like, bam!
Right.
You know, and one or the other, and whore is bam. Whore is...
Well, I was also thinking that, you know, the whores of the 19th century, who I've written about, who had all this power and were pretty unashamed, used that term a lot themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I was... Yeah, there's that resonance as well. So why this is what I'm not so sure about. I sort of get why you don't use the word prostitute because it's legalistic, but I know that there's a big aversion to that word among a lot of sex workers.
Well, it's
what is that?
It's an ugly word.
Okay.
It does have that legitimate legal meaning, right? That meaning where it's, no, this spells it out, right? And it's also, the fact that the prohibitionists have turned it into a verb. Well, I mean, no, it was a verb before. You know, we say, right, we say to prostitute one's talents and things like
which
that.
Which is to devalue or degrade one's talents.
Right, right. Yeah. Right. But, you know, but they've turned that verb into an adjective, prostituted. Mm-hmm. You know, so she was prostituted. She's a prostituted woman. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when you do that, it removes agency, right? If you say Maggie is a prostituted woman, you're implying that there is a prostitutor, that someone is prostituting me. It takes the agency away from me, and lends it to this imaginary person,
right?
That supposedly is doing this to me.
Yeah, agency, big. That's a big thing here. In the 19th century and into the 20th century, and really still today, of course, the most common argument made, I would say, by especially feminists, but I'd also say, you know, the Christian conservatives who have been the big prohibitionists as well, is that women who are prostitutes do it because they're forced to.
Right, because we're stupid. Because you see, our brains are tiny and withered and pink and fluffy. And right. So we can't conceive of the idea of sex for anything other than love and babies and other nice little feminine things like that. And so if we do something like say, guys want to fuck me, I got bills to pay, I know, I'll just charge them to fuck me. No, we're not supposed to think like that. Women are not supposed to think like that, right? It disarms a lot of people. They prefer to think of women as being like their mother or something. Well, mm-hmm. You know, of course, a lot of people's mothers are sex workers, right? But I mean, people like to pretend that their mothers are chaste and virginal and Madonna-like, and therefore that kind of idea is extended into all women, right?
Chaste and pure and Madonna-like and always ready to take care of you.
Yes.
Unlike you whores.
Who charge you.
You're interested in yourselves.
Yes.
And that is the worst thing a woman can do, be interested in herself.
I think you're right. No.
I think I am right, and I think that's why they hate you.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, there's a variant on that. That Laura Augustine, who coined the term rescue industry, that Laura Augustine talks about is that people associate women with home. And so a woman migrates to work, there's this disconnect. There's almost a cognitive dissonance in people's minds like, oh, well, she can't have done that on purpose. She must have been taken out because women are in the home. That's what women are. Women are home creatures, home bodies. And so if a woman's traveling across the world, going to another country, there's this belief among these conservative-minded people. And I'm using that term not to mean politically conservative, but to mean socially conservative in a sense. And a lot of feminists are, right? That they have these ideas that are very kind of old-fashioned. And so the idea that, oh, well, that can't be something she did on her own. She must have been taken from that. She must have been forced away. She was lured away. She was whatever, you know, whatever way they can negate the agency, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a major reason that prostitutes have been so hated. There's another thing going on, of course, which is Puritanism, which is our feelings about sex as being this special thing that is different than all other things. That is
magic.
Well, it's magic. It's black magic, right? Mm-hmm. It's dangerous,
right?
It's amazing and spectacular, but it's also dangerous, like black magic. And I think that's
a very good point.
Well, thank you.
I like that.
Yeah, I do too. I'll use it again.
Use it again.
You know, the original Puritans didn't think of it as amazing or spectacular. They just thought it was dangerous and evil. Then I think Americans became conflicted about sex, and that's where the idea of it being special in kind of good ways, but always dangerous, right?
Well, some comedian once said, I can't remember who he was, but he was from Texas, and he said something like, in Texas, we were raised with the idea that sex is horrible and dirty and terrible, and therefore you should say only do it with someone you love.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So it's the selling of it that drives people bananas.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's so strange, right? It's like, I guess it's the thought that you are willing to have sex with anyone that really is revolting to a lot of people, which isn't even true. First of all,
it's totally not true.
But even if it were true, you know, people do jobs all the time. There are all kinds of jobs that involve close, physical, intimate contact with customers who they cannot stand.
Absolutely. Nurses. I mean, nurses have to clean people's butts if they're like in a coma or something, right? To clean up the poop, all that stuff. And yet nobody thinks that's a problem. Nobody thinks that daycare is a problem. You're giving a stranger your baby to take care of. And yet for some reason, they don't seem to think that's too intimate, that we should make that illegal.
Sure.
There's a lot of things like that, right? And therapists. Mm-hmm. You're telling a therapist your deepest secrets.
Right.
And that's okay.
Right.
I mean, for goodness sake, when I go to my gynecologist, I mean, the feet go up into the stirrups and she's there sticking her hands and, you know, and nobody thinks that that's a problem.
It is remarkable. I don't know what to do with this. It's just, it's such a hard nut to crack. I mean, I, you know, to my students, I present all of these arguments to them over many weeks. And then after all of that, usually they just think, oh my God, I cannot believe prostitution is illegal.
Right.
But when they start the class, it's, you know, I say to them, so, I'm going to have a guest speaker come. What if it were a cashier at CVS? What would you think about that? How would you feel about her? And they say, I don't know, whatever, cashier. I say, okay, well, what if it were a prostitute? And then they all sort of think hard about that. And it's just like you have an aura. It's a scary, diseased aura or something. You know, it's just an entirely different realm. It's just something they can't imagine. It is something outside of their experience. That's the other thing that's all you see that among prohibitionists forever is this inability, sort of this amazement that this thing happens, that a woman would do this. And so they have to come up with these explanations for it.
And they're bizarre explanations.
Which are, well, there's been a range, by the way. So they have been, I'd say, nuanced in a sense in that there's a long list, but all of them require a complete lack of agency in the woman.
Yes.
So they have been, because I know this, I've studied it, poverty, right? That tends to be the favorite of feminists, right? Because women have been excluded from so-called normal occupations, and they tend to be poorer than men, and so they are forced to do this. Social conservatives have said things like, you know, they are alcoholics, they are drug addicts, they were forced by conniving, domineering men, pimps who kidnapped them and forced them into being sex slaves. That still is a trope, as you know.
Yes, and of course, the idea of sexual molestation, that, you know, that
right.
the majority of sex workers supposedly were molested as children.
Right. They're damaged.
Damaged goods.
They're damaged.
Damaged goods is very common.
Right.
You know, the idea is that there's higher rates of mental illness among
right.
sex workers. That's another mm-hmm. one of these tropes, right? That, oh, well, she can't be possibly normal, so there's something wrong with her.
And the other one, which you've already mentioned, is you're just very stupid.
Yeah, very stupid.
They're very stupid, stupid girls, and
know.
That's why they do it, because right. they don't know any better.
And that's one of the reasons I think that I have, I mean, as much of, I mean, you flattered me at the very beginning, but whatever part of that is true, to whatever degree that's true, I think one of the reasons I am prominent is because I have a, for whatever reason, my personality or my vocabulary or whatever, I have a hard time hiding that I'm fairly bright. And so I think that's one of the reasons is that basically as soon as I open my mouth and start talking, it slaps people in the face that this is a whore and she's intelligent.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's what's going on.
And actually when I started, there actually were prohibitionists out there, and they disappeared pretty quick. But for about the first year, there were prohibitionists running around who were claiming that I wasn't really a sex worker.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was obviously too smart to have ever been a sex worker.
Yeah, that's what's going on with social media. I think that's been the key thing, because if you follow sex workers on social media, what you see is very smart, very sharp, very fierce women who also, I think above all else, are independent. There's sort of an independence of mind. But that's exactly the opposite of how you're portrayed by the prohibitionists,
which is
that you're completely dependent on the pimp or society, or, you know, poverty has made you into this dependent person,
right?
Dependent on the trade. But that's, at least among the sex worker activists I know of and follow, it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of the problem, right? Because I think this is not so much a problem for, we've been talking about a lot of female prohibitionists over the past few minutes, but there's a lot of male prohibitionists too. I think one of the things that bothers male prohibitionists is the fact that we don't belong to a man. We're making money, and yet we don't have to belong to a man to do it, because nobody cares, right? If you're Melania Trump and you marry money. Nobody cares, right? If you're a Kardashian and you marry money, that's okay, because then you belong to one man. But I don't belong to one man, and I still make money from my sexuality, and and that scares people.
So here's what I think it is with men. I think we are scared of you because you don't care about us, and you never will. You're never going to take care of us as a mother or a wife.
You're never going to take care of you as a mother or wife.
That's what we want. We want women, I think a lot of men, a lot of heterosexual men really want that. They want women to like them, to love them in that way.
Yes, I think you're right.
And you don't. Sex workers don't. I mean, they could, but sort of by definition, that's not the relationship.
Correct, right? Correct. I mean, and there are clients, and I'm gonna put this caveat in here. Mm-hmm. There are clients that I genuinely care. I mean, I married a client, right? And even though we're not married anymore, it was not the fact of him being a client and me being a whore that caused our relationship to break up. It was the normal stuff that causes relationships to break up. And we were together for 14 years, for goodness sake. But my point is that you can be a doctor or a lawyer or a whore or a teacher or many other things. And there are going to be some clients you like better than others. There could be some clients that every time
like
they walk
job.
In your door,
like
you're
any other
like,
job.
I'm so glad to see, you know, I mean, right? Mm-hmm. Teacher's pet, right? You're a teacher, right? There's some students that you're just like, ah, this student is such a joy to work with.
Sure.
And there's other students that you're like, oh my God, you're not taking any of my classes. Please go away. And this is the way it is for us too, right? And then there's a big old group of people in the middle that are...
The problem, I think, for a lot of men, male prohibitionists, is that it's your choice.
Yes. Yes. And, not
and we don't know which way you're going to go with us, right?
That's right.
So it's, you could easily... Yeah, I can imagine that's what scares a lot of them and pushes them into this position of needing to be, you know, oppositional. Although, don't you think there's more... hostility among women?
Oh yeah. Okay. I wrote a column just not even 2 weeks ago. I think it was like Monday last, about that. I mean, that acknowledging that there are more, if you see polls consistently women vote in polls for criminalization more than men do. And of course the feminist thing is, oh, that's because men want to have access, blah, 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 blah. No, because men are going to pay for sex, whether it's legal or not, right? Mm-hmm. So to say that men only want prostitution to be legal because of their own greedy reasons, that's silly, because I guarantee you that I have plenty and plenty and plenty of clients, and I make a very good living, and it doesn't matter that it's illegal, right?
I think I told you the story about a woman when I was giving my first book to her who accused me in public of writing that chapter for that reason. Did I tell you this?
No.
Yeah, I gave a talk at Linfield College, not far from here in Oregon. And I gave the whole talk and I focused on the prostitutes chapter. And at the end of the talk, I mean, through the whole talk, this woman was looking at me and I knew it was trouble. She had this look in her eye. And I called on her and she said, yeah, I don't believe any of this. And I think you are saying this and you wrote that so that you can get cheaper prostitutes.
Well, this is the kind of thing, right? It's cognitive dissonance. When the cognitive dissonance starts... they have to come up with some way to let that pressure off. So they make up some dumb excuse in their mind and then they invest. Oh, one of my favorite dumb excuses is the idea that, and this is a feminist one, that the availability of sex workers teaches men to think that they are entitled to sex.
That's a big
which
one.
Is the most opposite thing there is, because by my saying, it is going to cost you $400 to have sex with me.
Exactly.
That I am telling you flat out, you are not entitled to sex with me. You are entitled to exactly what I give you, and I'm going to give you, and here's the conditions I'm giving it to you under. No, I'm not going to let you charm me into, you know, putting out. I am not going to just give it to you in return for dinner. I am not going to give it to you because you told me I was pretty. You can't shame me into it. And no, I'm not going to get drunk and let you have it either. And I'm not going to let you have it without a condom. This is the opposite of teaching entitlement, right? Mm-hmm. This is boundary.
That's exactly right.
Whores set boundaries better than any other women in the world.
That's a hell of an argument, and I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Yep.
My goodness. That's right. So then why on earth do so many women hate you so much?
In that column I was referring to a few minutes ago, I theorized that part of it is because women tend to, and again, these things we're talking about tendencies, right? Women, I think, tend to be more collective-minded than men are. Women tend to, we seek consensus. We go to the bathroom in groups, things like that, right? Women, I think, a guy is less likely to look at another man who's behaving in some way he considers bad and say, that casts a bad image on all men. Guys don't do that, right? But women do that. Women look at other women behaving in a way that they consider bad, and they say, oh, that makes all women look bad. And guys don't really do that. And so I think what a lot of it is women simply wanting other women to toe the line and get in line behind them and act in a way that they consider to be respectable and good and whatever. And they are upset when women don't do that. And people come up with all these different kinds of things like mate guarding and stuff. I'm like, well, then why are so many lesbians anti-sex work?
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't care at all about what men, want sexually or like sexually or their availability, or whatever. And so I also think about things like when I was young, like in the 80s, in the lesbian community, and lesbians policing other lesbians and basically saying, oh, no, you must be this way. You can't do this or you're not a real lesbian. You can't do this or you're not a real lesbian. We still have the concept today of a gold star lesbian, right? It's like, oh, if you've ever had a penis in you, then you're not a gold star lesbian.
I have not heard this concept. What's a gold star lesbian?
It's a lesbian who's never had a penis in her.
Oh.
Who's never been with a man even one single time.
I've not heard that.
Yes. Gold star lesbian.
Good to know.
Yeah.
I mean, and then one of the classic feminist arguments against prostitution is that it continues the historical association of women with the body and sexuality, which has kept them down. So that
except that feminists are the ones who make the most noise about women's bodies constantly. I mean, you don't hear men running around saying that the existence of He-Man action figures gives little boys a weird body image. But you see women saying this about Barbies, because so they're the ones that are fixated on the body more than I think.
Yeah.
Or to an equal degree, at least.
They're actually on one level correct in that, of course, it does associate women with the body and sexuality. It says on one level, I could see this as an interpretation that's reasonable, that, this is what women can sell, and so they are selling it. They can't so easily sell their ability to do quantum physics.
Unless they actually can.
I know.
Can do quantum physics,
but I think
can sell it.
I would say that mainstream sort of first and second wave feminists, that's been one of their major arguments.
I'll concede
is that, what you're
that
doing,
there is some basis there.
Is that what you're doing is confirming in men's minds that that's all you have to offer, that's a value in the society.
Even sex work is not always about sex.
Right.
But even when it is, that's okay, right? Because sex is okay. Sex is not a bad thing.
It's this phenomenally deep cultural assumption that it is dangerous or bad, that it does harm, it's damaging.
And sex, I think...
unless it's done in exactly the right way.
In exactly the right way, yes. And here's the thing, right?
And even then, it's a little scary, right? Even if it's, with your wife, it's still... You don't show that in public.
Right.
We're ashamed of that too.
Right.
Right. Even that is not really totally okay.
I mean, well, I guess, I mean,
it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, we don't. We hide that.
These cultural taboos.
Yeah,
and
it's incredible. So you're working against a lot here.
Yeah. Oh,
you
yeah.
Here's the thing. And this is why I am, so passionate about it. It's like your movement is challenging the most fundamental aspects of our society. This is the
fundamental taboo.
This
certainly.
Is the bedrock. I think it's just everything actually is built on our ideas about sex. I mean,
oh yeah,
Freud and I sort of agree on that.
No. Yeah. I would go with that. Except the one thing I would say, and this is a little controversial. I'm going to say that this is only me saying this, and this is not necessarily a prevalent sex worker rights opinion. Although you know there are others who agree with me, but not always. And that's that. I think we're necessary. I think we're necessary for society the way it's built to continue. I think that there's a without us, there's monogamy as we understand it would not be possible. I'm not saying in every case, right? There are some guys who absolutely never stray. But the fact of the matter is there's a large enough fraction who do to where there needs to be that managed route for them to do that. You know, if a guy wants to fool around on his wife and he is not able to afford, or he's afraid to, or there's just not around or whatever, to go to a sex worker, what's he going to do? He's not just going to keep it in his pants. He's going to go and try to pick up other girls, and he's going to try to, you know, and when his flirtations or infidelities are discovered, it's going to break up the marriage. It's going to break up, you know, the household, all that stuff. Whereas my gentleman can come to me and I'm interested in only one thing, and that is their money. And they pay me and I do my thing, and then they go away and I stay away and I don't bother them. I don't call them. I don't say, when are you going to leave your wife? And I don't say, you don't have enough, you don't spend enough time with me. And I don't say any of that stuff, right? And I don't say, well, why do you have a picture of her in your wallet and not me? I don't do any of that stuff, right? Because I'm just there to do a job.
Charlie Sheen said, I pay prostitutes
to leave. Exactly.
Yeah, it was a great line.
It is a great line, and it's very true, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is the thing, and this is why we're necessary.
Well, okay, so I think you're right that
harm reduction.
I think you're right that prostitution has often kept marriages intact, and it has made monogamy, in a sense, possible in many cases. But for me, that is an argument against monogamy and marriage more than it is an argument for sex work.
Well, that's one of the reasons I only talk about it in this kind of a venue.
To me, what that does is it sort of reveals how basically impossible long-term monogamy is, and how shaky an edifice marriage is, and how much repression is required to have a lifelong marriage.
I would agree with that.
Okay, so marriage and the family are absolutely the bedrock of this society. That institution, you know, ask any great American in history and they will tell you that, right?
Of course.
I think they're right. And so you're challenging that. You are sort of exposing it for what it is, which is damn near impossible to maintain.
Well, that's it,
on its
right?
own.
That's what it is that because we are necessary to make it happen, and I think a lot of prohibitionists know that,
mm-hmm.
and they hate us for it.
Yeah.
They hate us for it because we made them realize, oh, shit, this thing we believe in is Santa Claus. It's the Easter Bunny. It's something that is a fairy tale that is very nice for children. And it's very nice to believe in when you just want a light, fluffy story like The Princess Bride. And you just want to watch something that's fun and that's not realistic. And you want to feel good, right? But in real life, we can't base real life on that, right? Real
right.
life, we need, there need to be safety valves, and there need to be mechanisms, and there need to be, right?
Yeah, I know many people who got married to their high school sweetheart, the first person they had sex with, and who are now in their 30s and 40s or 50s. And I wonder, either have they really done this? And how long can you do that? It just seems impossible.
Some
to me.
People can do it.
It's one
Some
thing
people can.
It's one thing to begin a long-term monogamous relationship in your 40s, right? Or in 50s. Okay, I kind of get that. But my goodness, I don't see how that could really work in very many cases. So the other argument the feminists make against you and your kind that you are, and this is connected to the other argument about associating women with the body and sexuality, which is that what you're doing is you're promoting, it is a form of sexual objectification, that you are reducing, prostitutes are reducing women once again to their body parts, to their sexuality. The argument has been made for about 200 years now, and is still made all the time, that the more sexual objectification of women there is in a society, the less women will succeed, move forward in other areas of society. So that the more that we have, I'm setting this up because it's such a bad argument, but this is what's been said. The more pornography we have, the more bikini models we have, the more prostitutes we have, the fewer scientists and senators and poets we will have as women. We both want to smash this. But you've heard this argument, right?
Of course I've heard it.
Okay, so I've been thinking about this a lot, in part because the leader of the anti-sexual assault craziness, I'd say, at Occidental College a few years ago, made this argument. I think it was a TED Talk or something, and she laid it out there. And I thought, wow, this is like 2015, and you're still saying this. Look around. Let's look at the historical record on this question. Right. Okay. So when did women leave the house at all? When did they start doing that? The 19th century. Okay. When did sexual objectification of women in the public sphere begin? The 19th century. Funny. When did sexual objectification, pornography, prostitution, the use of women's bodies in advertising, all that stuff, when did that take off and become bigger and bigger? The 20th century. What also happened in the 20th century with women in the United States at the very same time? They became, more and more of them were senators and congresspeople and right. scientists and poets right. and novelists and the rest of it and the professors. And now they've taken over colleges entirely. Most college students are now female, et cetera. Most MDs now annually are women. Majority of MDs are women.
Yeah,
now.
I believe that.
Meanwhile, we have more sexual objectification of women in the public sphere than ever before, because my 15-year-old son can anytime go on the internet and watch two people fucking in any kind of way he wants.
Right.
But my goodness, how does that work with this argument about how sexual objectification of women will keep them from doing other things?
Well, it's the same thing as...
It is exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and it's the same thing as the thing about porn, right? I mean, there's a bunch of studies that have shown this, that as porn has become more available, the rates of sexual assault and things like that have gone down. Now, I'm not saying that there's a causative relationship, but I'm saying that whatever the social forces are that are they're moving in tandem, right? The rape rate, you know, sexual assault rate is going down and the porn rate is going up, and whether one causes the other or not is immaterial.
Right.
And it's the same thing here. What you're saying is that I kind of think probably that I would love to be able to believe, as a whore myself, I would love to be able to believe that the increasing visibility of whores is causing women to become more equal. I don't really believe that, though.
Yeah,
I believe that there's a correlation, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of that correlation, I think, is that women are more respected as individuals. And so when, except for people, except for people like these rad femmes and fundamentalists and such, that women's choices, women being accepted more as individuals and their choices being respected more, leads to them feeling more free to explore these sort of things and do these sort of jobs and such like that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, before, they would have been basically slapped down and right? Because, I mean, it wasn't in, how long ago was it? Not that long ago in Western culture that a woman basically passed from her father's, from ownership by her father to ownership by her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at, well, when you're an historian, right? You know about this, is that it's, for a lot of women in Western culture, it was only after they became a widow that they became actually free actors.
Mm-hmm. Right, because within a marriage, they had no legal rights.
Right. And then once they're a widow, all of a sudden, now their daddy doesn't own them, and their husband doesn't own them, and now they can move. And they have money, possibly, from the marriage. And,
Which is why pretty much the only women in the United States in the 19th century who had serious wealth were, guess who?
Yes, us.
Those who chose not to marry and chose to make money.
Yes.
Exploiting men, it has been said, in a sense.
Well, and the thing is, I mean, really, when you get right down to it, I mean, it is free trade, of course, you know. But yes, exploiting the existence of the...
Exploiting in a voluntary way. I mean, I'm not saying that it's like slavery in that way.
No, nobody's tricking.
But you're exploiting the great demand that men have for sex.
Yes.
And that's what happened in the 19th century with all the whores who moved to the Western boom towns where there were, you know, 10,000 men and five women.
Absolutely.
They could charge whatever they wanted to, and they became rich and powerful and very independent.
I have never made more money in my career as a whore than I did in the first few years in New Orleans. And that was because even though the population, there's no boomtown type situation there, but because, I guess maybe because of Catholicism or something, I'm not sure, the number of women in New Orleans, despite its reputation, who actually want to do sex work is actually kind of low. And so the number of sex workers in New Orleans is lower per capita than in a lot of other cities. And so the whores that are there make more money.
Why is it lower in New Orleans?
I don't know.
That doesn't make any sense.
I haven't a clue. But the fact of the matter is we could charge more in New Orleans than girls in Dallas could
charge. It's called supply and demand.
Supply and demand.
That's all it was and all it is now. Yeah. Right. All right. So we have now, I think, demolished every single argument for prohibition. Is there any left?
No, there's probably some other ones we're not thinking. There's some really
stupid ones and
crazy ones out there.
What are we missing? Come on.
I mean,
put our heads together here. They've come up with something.
The image ones. There's the, there's the ones that are based purely on lies, you know, like the idea that the existence of legal sex work magically makes illegal sex work increase, even though it works the opposite way in every other form of prohibition.
Right. So I'm thinking of what I just saw, this thing that insanely terrible piece of quote scholarship about Germany.
Oh God!
I think I got it from
you. Neumeier, Cho, and Dreyer.
A couple weeks ago, somebody. It was about the German. We'll talk about Germany. Talk about the Swedish model. We'll start with Germany. So, what's happened in Germany, and what was this person claiming about Germany?
Well, Germany. Okay, what happened is that sex work historically in Germany kind of went back and forth a lot, you know, over the centuries between, you know, crazy penalties against and you know, a fairly laissez-faire type arrangement. Within the 20th century, of course, we saw in Weimar Germany, it was, you know, completely a free-for-all. And then, of course, under the Nazis, you know, we were sent to concentration camps. So you definitely had this kind of going back and forth in Germany, right? And then after the war, sex work was never quite prohibited per se, but it was always sort of a patchwork among the various German states. Some places it was more strictly regulated than others. Some places it was. And then in 2002, they passed a package of legislation that basically was intended to kind of even it out and kind of correct some of the big differences. Mm-hmm. It still gives every state in Germany the right to do its own thing. And so there are some places like Bavaria where it's very hard to work as a sex worker. It's extremely difficult. And there's places like Berlin where it's pretty wide open. Mm-hmm. And each state can determine that for themselves.
So have any of the states adopted the Swedish model?
No.
Okay. Okay. So, I mean, what I've read mostly by prohibitionist types is that what's going on, and I don't really know, but in Berlin in particular, I guess there are these mega brothels.
There are mega brothels.
Okay.
Yeah, there are mega brothels. Huge things. I would never work in one, but that doesn't mean that other people don't. I would never work at Walmart either.
I was going to say, I mean,
there's a lot of things
in that and
do.
A corporate office building that's a skyscraper.
Well, right? Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing, right? Is that if you want to work in any particular career, let's use doctors for an example. You can be the doctor in private practice who moves out to a small rural town and you're just the country doctor, or you can work in a gigantic hospital where absolutely nobody except your immediate staff knows your name and you're doctor number 375, mm-hmm. you know?
Sure.
And the same thing goes
for whoring. Trying to say it's just like any other kind of work?
Yes.
Is that what you're...
Yes.
I wasn't sure. I wanted to make sure.
Yes.
Okay, so the claim, so they're claiming, right, that this has led to, this has created a situation in which, what are they saying? That there's more prostitution now, right? That there are more prostitutes, that they are making less money. I saw that claim, which I could possibly could be true in some
situation.
Well, supply and demand, if you remove it from the black market, I suppose.
The prices can, some of the prices do, when you see decriminalization systems and legalization systems, the prices do go down a little bit for the same reason, right? Mm-hmm. That,
like with drugs,
mm-hmm. right? I mean, I can buy in Seattle, an edible for like $3, a 10 milligram edible for $3. And I mean, I don't, you know, obviously there was no quality control where you knew exactly how many milligrams were in edible, but I don't think prior to legalization that you could get, you know, an edible of that strength quite that cheaply. I think it was probably would have been more than that. Because of the, you know, the thing. One of my peculiarities is I never tried marijuana until I got to a place where it was legal. So I'm not really sure.
That's right. You had never smoked weed until you moved to Seattle.
That's right.
Which was, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, 2 years ago. I know.
Amazing.
Maggie McNeil, the career criminal, had never tried.
Well, that's one of many interesting ironies in your biography, which we will talk about in a minute.
So what happens is, what I see is in... some escorts still charge quite a bit. But what happens is kind of a middle ground opens up, I guess, is what happens in legalization. You get this kind of bargain price group. In other words, under criminalization, you get, of course, some at the very bottom of the price range, you know, the people who are desperate, who are doing survival sex work, right? And that's going to be the same under legalization, criminalization, it's going to be the same everywhere because what they're working on is desperation, right? But everybody else pretty much is up in the, what you might call high-tier escort range. I hate to use terms like high, but I'm talking about prices, mm-hmm. not value as a human being.
Right.
And when you legalize... you get a kind of a middle ground. You get a lot of women who are going to try to base it on their business model is then going to turn to volume. Okay, I can't command the prices that Maggie can command. So I'm instead going to just do more than Maggie does. You know, right? It's like if Maggie sees 4 or 5 people a week, you know, I'm going to see 4 or 5 people a day. And I'm going to blow her out of the water. Money-wise, right, she'll make more than me because even if she's charging less, while I'm waiting for one $400 guy, she's seeing $350 guys.
That is also one of the claims that's made about the problem with what's going on in Germany, which is that these places, these mega brothels have become factories in which the women have to have sex with 5 or 10 men or 15 men, some
There are still
huge
escorts
number,
in Germany.
Every single day.
But there are still escorts in Germany. There are still girls whose model is based upon having...
But even if that's true, right, what you're saying is, so what?
Right.
It's work.
It's work.
So, yeah, I mean, it's more work, like, you know, being an accountant for 10 hours instead of 4 hours is more work, right?
Right. And another thing about Germany is that you've got to remember is that Germany also happens to be in fairly close proximity to a number of countries where sex work is illegal or where it's maybe not technically illegal anymore, but it's really still very, very frowned on, right? The farther east you go and the closer to the former communist sphere you get, right? There's all these countries where sex work is still illegal or still highly, highly stigmatized, like way much more than in Western Europe. And the fact of the matter is that's just a physical proximity issue. In other words, it's a false correlation. It's because that's the closest they can be to home and still do sex work legally. And so, yeah, naturally you're going to see in Germany a larger number of migrant sex workers and things like that because it's just a physical proximity issue. That is eradicated if sex work is legal or decriminalized everywhere.
Right.
That goes away.
So we haven't used this word yet. It's amazing. We're an hour in and we haven't used this word. Trafficking. Those women, those Eastern European women, this is the other claim that's made about them is that they are forced to do this, that they are in some way coerced in Hungary or Russia and then pulled over the border by, I guess, pimps and made to work in those mega brothels in Berlin.
Romania is the one that's now got the... Romania is the Cambodia of Europe now, as far as in the trope. I mean, mm-hmm. in other words...
That's the one with the stigma.
If you're going to pick an Asian country that you're going to represent your
bad thing.
Your enslaved sex slave woman, they're going to say it's Cambodia or Thailand. Mm-hmm. If it's Europe, they're going to say Romania.
Okay.
We could sit here for 2 hours analyzing why that may be so.
Yeah.
Certainly when the Iron Curtain fell, right, a lot of women moved out of the former communist, of the now formerly communist countries into Western Europe. I mentioned Laura Augustin a while back. One of the things she points out is that when coercion happens, a lot of the coercion has nothing to do with the fact that it's sex work. A lot of the coercion has to do with the fact that Western countries have set up these ridiculous border processes that normal people cannot navigate on their own. And so they have to hire somebody who is skilled at doing that, right? If I want to go into a country, like one of the countries in Africa that are war-torn, right? And I want to come into Europe. Well, I have to pay somebody who knows how to navigate that system.
Right.
I have to pay somebody who can sneak me across the border, who knows how to bribe the guards, who knows how to make the proper paperwork.
A trafficker.
Right?
Yeah.
And none of that would exist if the borders were open right. in the first place.
It's an immigration issue.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, don't go blaming sex work, because the women who become maids and the women who become beggars and the women who do everything else and the men who do that too, for that matter, they're undergoing the same process. They're also having to pay off these people. The difference is sex isn't involved, and so therefore the Puritans don't care about them.
Right.
Nobody cares about the guys who are picking fruit in California for whatever, $2 an hour or whatever they do it for. Nobody cares about them, right? Because there's no sex.
Yeah.
So why should we care about them?
Right.
Right? But as soon as there's sex involved, one of the things I think is really, really interesting is how much of this is tied up in racism, right? We went in the United States in the 90s from hearing all these, you know, all this anchor baby talk and stuff like that. Basically, you know, women who are migrating from Mexico being cast as villains. They're coming here to steal jobs. They're coming here to steal welfare. They're having anchor babies. Right. And then as soon as the sex trafficking narrative is in place, now magically these villainous Mexican women suddenly become victims
who need to be saved,
but
in a different way.
What's the end result? The end result in both cases is, in the first case, in the 90s case, we have to send those bad women back to their country. We have to deport them. In the now case, it's, we have to repatriate them, which is a nice way of saying deport.
Yep.
We're still sending them back. We're just using a, quote, nice reason, close quote, for doing it. And when you see in the Scandinavian countries that racism becomes even more obvious, because back, you know, again, in the when the Iron Curtain first fell, right, who were the first wave of migrants coming into the Scandinavian countries? People from Eastern Europe. People whose language was similar to the Scandinavian language. People whose cultures were not that dissimilar, mm-hmm. right? So even though they were made uncomfortable by these people, they were still white. Many of them were still, you know, fair-complected. Their languages sounded kind of Germanic-y, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They could kind of, yeah, we can handle this. Then what was the next wave? The next wave were the Balkan people. Oh, no, some of them are dark-skinned. Oh, some of them are Muslim.
Yep.
Right? Oh, so now all of a sudden the Scandinavians start to get more anxious about this. Oh, they don't like this as much. And so all the talk about prostitution starts, all the talk about trafficking starts. And then when the Nigerians started to come in, all of a sudden it's, we need to make it illegal and we need to send them back home. The blacker the immigrants got, the more upset the Swedes and the Norwegians got about it. I don't know about you, but I call that racism.
Yeah, although, well, I mean, this is a different kind of racism, though. In this country, I'd say it's been more, the fear has been of the dark other man kidnapping and enslaving the white girl, right? That's the white slavery panic of the early 20th century.
Right. It's come back.
So it's not so much the darker women, but yeah. Yeah. And I was going to say that in response to the white slavery panic of the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s, a lot of people don't know this unless they've read articles that I've written, that the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was established to counter that very problem.
Yes. Yeah.
The FBI originated in and because of the white slavery panic, and what it ended up being was a crackdown on immigration.
Yes.
Because what the Bureau of Investigation at the time it was called said, and somewhat correctly, said that a lot of these prostitutes are coming from Europe.
Right.
And so what we need to do is tighten our security at the borders. At Ellis Island, we need to be asking more questions of these immigrants. And if they don't give us the right answers, we need to turn them around. And next thing we know, 1920, 1924 were the major immigration restriction laws. That was the origin of it, actually, was anti-whore legislation and an anti-whore police force.
And far be it from me to point this out to you as an historian, but just for the listeners, I want to bring this up. I've always thought it was very telling that the very first United States federal level immigration law was also the very first anti-prostitution law, the Federal DuPage Law of 1872, 73?
Gosh, I don't know.
Around there?
I'll take your word for it.
But it was, it's the predecessor to the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it's the one saying that no woman can enter the country for immoral purposes, which really was code for Chinese sex workers and Chinese second and third wives in polygamous marriages, who were being, called, immoral. Mm-hmm. And so the very first immigration law is also the first anti-whore law. They're tied inextricably together.
And guess what trafficking is used for? The trafficking idea and terminology and laws against it in this country are used for?
Oh, immigration.
One, prostitution.
Yeah.
Voluntary, consensual, sex work. And two, immigration. This is what most people really don't know, is that many, many people who have been prosecuted for trafficking really are just immigrants, and they get turned around.
Yes.
So there have been a whole bunch of immigrants who have been denied entry because they were accused of trafficking with no real reason, no evidence. There was that case on Alaska Airlines recently that stewardess called in
the case
some
that didn't
guy.
Exist.
Yeah, she saw some guy. This was like last year, just a few months ago.
Well, no, Elizabeth Nolan Brown unpacked this because it was actually a several years old case.
Okay, right.
And what Liz Brown did, she went digging in and she found that the year that this supposedly happened at the airport, there's no mention of it in the news.
Right.
The
guy just disappeared. The case disappeared.
Right.
The whole thing disappeared.
Because it didn't exist in the first place. It was just a made up story.
Right.
And this is the problem, right? Is that I actually had quite a bit of schadenfreude this week, and I'm reveling in it because did you see this crazy story where this woman thought that because a male looked at her in IKEA, that meant her children were going to be sex trafficked?
I did.
And what happened was there was this huge panic on Facebook, right? And these anti-trafficking people tried to go in and correct these people saying, no, 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 it doesn't happen that way. And they got their own rhetoric thrown back at them, which I'm enjoying the hell out of, because this is the thing, right? Is that they've created this monster and they can't control it, right? They made up all these silly lies, and now the silly lies are running around without them. And the fact of the matter is they're just making it up. They were just making it up from the start.
Yeah.
And now they're seeing the danger of making it up, because here's the thing. When you, because this is so tied into people's morals and sexual morals and think of the children and all that kind of stuff, as soon as you question that, you get finger pointing. As soon as you, I get this all the time, right? You're exploiting other women. You're in favor of child sex trafficking. You're a pimp, blah, 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 and so on and so forth. Because you're stepping on their toes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And So that's what that story about the stewardess. This, right, it fills in all the blanks. It's all the things we like to hear.
Should just so people don't know, it was some stewardess on Alaska Airlines saw a man and a girl flying together, and I don't know, something about their behavior, according to her, indicated to her that the girl was doing this involuntarily, and she slipped a note to the girl when she was in the bathroom. It's all shadowy.
It's a lot of nonsense.
So I did all the research on this. The white slavery panic of the early 20th century, which I've already mentioned, the evidence for actual slavery of women in the sex trade during that time is zero.
Yeah.
There's one tiny, slight, little ambiguous piece of evidence about one woman maybe was held against her will in some building in New York City, but that's it. And it's really not confirmed. There's basically none. But yet again, it was...
Yeah.
But many, many Americans were convinced that this was a mass phenomenon.
They're convinced, just like they're convinced
and
now.
You know, just as now. So when you look at the numbers, and Liz Brown does a great job at this on Reason, and you do too.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of people do, but you guys are, I think you're the two best at that. Look at the numbers. Look at what actually goes on. When the cops in this country do a bust of traffickers, it is 100%. Well, it's prostitution.
It's right. People. It's okay. All prostitution.
Now, it's both pimps and it's the prostitutes themselves. Now, the only place, and this is where the argument gets tough for your side, is that some of those are children. Well, technically, legally children.
They're girls underage.
Under the age of 18, right?
Yeah, so that's 16 or 17, so nearly always.
I think this is correct. According to the law here in the United States, anytime a person under the age of 18 sells sex, it is by definition trafficking.
Well, sure.
It is, right.
But the thing is, if you define something, I mean, this is going to seem off the subject, but it's not. In the Netherlands a couple of years ago, they raised the age at which a sex worker could legally work from 18 to 21, and they established a requirement that she had to be able to speak Dutch. Then a year later, they were all up in arms because the rate of illegal prostitution had gone up. It's like, yeah, because you just defined a bunch of legal sex workers as illegal. Of course the number goes up.
Right.
I mean, if I'm the language empress and I suddenly say that from now on, all cats are to be called dogs, and then there's a dog population explosion, well, there's no surprise, right? Because we've just now said a lot of things that we didn't call that before. Now we're calling that. And the same thing here. If you're going to define, regardless of force, fraud, or coercion, if you're going to define anyone under 18 as being the mental and volitional equivalent of a 3-year-old, yeah, duh, you're going to get a lot of cases like that. Because the fact of the matter is, I don't know about you, Thad, but when I was 15 and 16, I was running around pretty much fucking willy-nilly. And I didn't care who told me it was wrong. And I didn't care what my mother said. And if I thought I wanted to do something, I did it. And that is the way that 16 and 17-year-olds have always been.
But shouldn't we stop them from doing that because it's dangerous behavior?
How?
So that's the argument, is that it can't be stopped.
My argument is that if you want to stop, right, if you look at one of the statistics I think that's very telling, is that in adult sex work, only about 10% of adult sex workers are genetically male. Okay? 10%. But according to the John Jay study, John Jay Criminal College did a study a few years ago. According to the John Jay study in New York City, which is where they did the study, 50% of underage sex workers are male. 50%. And yet, as soon as you cross the line of magic 18, it drops to 10%. Why do you think that is? The reason, I think, is because at 18, those boys can now legally get jobs, whereas before they needed their parents to sign for them because of the child labor laws, right? So if you're a runaway or a throwaway, because the majority of underage sex workers are, right? The majority of underage sex workers are, a lot of them are GLBT kids. A lot of them are trans kids. are there are queer kids who have been thrown out of their homes because their parents can't accept that, or they didn't get necessarily thrown out, but basically the home environment became so hostile they had to get out, or they're girls who were molested, or, you know, all those kind of things, right? So they can't go home. They can't walk up to their parents and say, would you please sign this so I can get a, quote, legitimate, close quote, job? But they still have to survive, right? And so they do sex work because they can. Because they can charge and get money and use that to survive. You want to get rid of underage sex work? I've said this before. A, make it easier for underage people to get emancipated. And B, you've got to have drop-in shelters. You've got to take all that money that you're using to have cops chase and after underage people. How about taking that money and establishing shelters where they can come, where there are beds they can sleep in, where they can get free food, where they can take a shower? I guarantee you a lot of those underage sex workers will disappear, because a lot of those underage sex workers are in it to get a roof over their head and a bed and food. And if you remove the necessity for them to have to work to do those things, then those kids, those ones that are in it for that, will now not be sex workers anymore. They'll drop out.
Instead, we make them criminals.
Exactly.
And we have, as you said, the police deal with them.
Yes. And there are these awful laws. They're called safe harbor laws, which is an incredibly Orwellian name for them. Because they pretend. There was one in California passed recently, and a lot of states have them, where it's you can't prosecute someone under 18 for prostitution. And everybody thinks, oh, this is a wonderful idea. Yeah, but the fine print says you can hold them indefinitely without charge for their own good.
Right.
To, quote, protect them from the pimps, close quote. So, yeah, because when you don't charge someone criminal, they're not protected by the Miranda rights, right? They don't have the right to a lawyer because they're not being arrested. They don't have a right to know the charges against them because there aren't any, right? So they put them in these, what I call gingerbread houses, these disguised prisons. They're calling them something else. Hmm. Oh, we're protecting you, from the pimps, but they're locked in.
Right.
They can't get out.
And I love the stories when the kids escape from those places.
Right. You know, the pimps came and abducted them out of there.
The story is always, you know, we saved them from the streets,
right,
but then they ran away from the place we put them in.
Right. Well, a lot of times they claim that the pimps come in there and abduct them from there. The pimps, like ninja pimps, they walk through the walls like Shaolin.
Oh, right. The claim is that there's this mind control that pimps have.
Yeah, mind control.
Continues.
Right. Yes, it's like that scene in Dracula where, you know, where Renfield looks out the window and sees Dracula controlling him from the lawn, you know, and then the pimps, I guess, are looking into the safe house window and the girl, you know, sneaks out or whatever. Yeah, it's mind-boggling, these magic powers that are ascribed to pimps. And
because women can't possibly have
on their own
the agency. Yeah, they can't possibly do it on their own.
Well, we can't. We're according to the prohibitionists, we can't figure out how to put ads on Backpage on our own. We can't figure out how to get hotel rooms on our own. We can't book airline tickets on our own. We can't buy bus tickets on our own. We're too stupid to handle any of that, and so men must be doing it.
It is amazing. Oh. Yep. It is. It's actually the opposite of feminism.
It's completely the opposite.
So-called feminist prohibitionism is actually the exact opposite of feminism.
Yes, it is.
It says that women have no agency and no power and must be protected by the state, which is run by men.
Yes.
Yes. It's the exact opposite of feminism.
Yes. It's nothing like feminism.
Let's do the Swedish model, and then I want to talk about your life.
Okay.
Your history.
My history. I'm game.
And did you have any agency in your history, in your life? Have you, or is this a new thing? Just kidding.
Agency?
Just kidding.
Oh, okay.
I know you had agencies.
I did. Yeah. I owned one.
Yeah, right.
Which makes me a pimp, according to the, you know.
You had lots of agency and agencies. All right. So the Swedish model, a lot of people still don't know what it is. It's very sexy, so to speak, among feminists now.
Yes.
I would say, is it safe to say that most feminists who are aware of it are for it? Second wave, sort of public feminists, you know, with a profile.
Sex worker exclusionary feminists.
which is
SWERFs, as they're called.
Which is, isn't it most second wave feminists?
I mean, how many
self-identified, you know, public intellectual feminists are not prohibitionists?
The number is growing.
Really? Name some.
Yeah, the number is growing.
Name three.
I try not to remember the names, frankly, of
this is a good one. I'm talking about the good ones.
But, well, I mean, no, seriously, there are a lot of women who identify, especially like in libertarianism. I mean, Liz Brown, we were just talking about her. She identifies as feminist.
Okay, one.
But, I mean, so there are writers like this is what I'm saying. Mostly libertarian feminist types.
Okay.
Who identify, they do use the word feminist, and yet they are not.
I can't think of any. Except, I mean, I can't think of any.
All the big loud ones.
I can't think of any sort of on the left. There is this possible? There's no left-wing feminists?
No, there are some. No, there are some. I can't call anything to mind right now. But I have a column.
My guess is a woman named Liza Featherstone. I would bet she's good on this because I think she's married to Doug Henwood, who's a pretty big lefty intellectual, and I think they're pretty good on sex, actually, for lefties. But it's very few.
But the number is growing, though. Okay. I have a regular feature that goes in my news columns called Watershed, mm-hmm. and under Watershed, I link essays I've found by prominent women, female journalists, self-identified feminists, etc., arguing for decriminalization.
Okay.
And I'm seeing more and more and more of those in the past 3 or 4 years.
I haven't, but yeah. That's good.
Amnesty's coming out supporting decrim, I think made it possible for a lot of women who were identified as feminists who may have felt that way but just couldn't say it out loud to now say it out loud. Because now they can say, well, look at Amnesty as evidence, right? I mean, even in New Hampshire, recently, some female legislators introduced a decrim bill. I mean, I don't know how far it's going to get, but the fact of the matter is these were female legislators. These are not sex workers. These are not people who we would normally expect. But when Amnesty came out and said it was okay, then it became okay.
Explain the difference between decriminalization and legalization.
The best one-sentence explanation I have is one that an Australian journalist came out with a few years ago, and I think it's a brilliant one sentence explanation, which is under legalization, sex work is still conceived of as a crime for which the law makes allowances. So in Nevada, for example, the one Americans are going to mostly be familiar with, right? The cops still chase after sex workers like crazy in Reno and in Las Vegas, you know, and they're still putting out all the prohibitionist propaganda. They're still blathering at the mouth about pimps and all this kind of, you know, crap. Whereas just a few miles away in the desert, it's legal. But it's only legal if you work for a licensed pimp in a licensed brothel under these certain conditions.
Whose name is Dennis Hoff.
50% of them.
I know.
Way out in the desert, right? So we're saying that under these conditions, we're allowing these criminals to function in this, you know, thing. It's not the same as decriminalization, in which you're basically saying, this is a job, this is work.
Right. The state might allow you to perform this activity.
Right.
But it still has jurisdiction over it.
Correct.
That's the thing. Yeah.
Correct. Right. Correct. So it's kind of like tolerance.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Or like states which or like Washington, you know, where I live now, until recently, I don't remember exactly when it was before I moved up there. But I think it was sometime in the 21st century where the state used to own all the liquor stores. And it was fairly recently that they let that go,
mm-hmm.
and now started letting private liquor stores. Right. So the state still held that old prohibition from 1933. That the state was still hanging on to that control and finally let it go.
It has jurisdiction over your body.
Yes.
And by the way, if you read the fine print, not the fine print, if you read Roe v. Wade, the actual decision by the Supreme Court, it states very clearly that the state maintains power over the body, jurisdiction over it. It is not giving it up in this case. It's just allowing women to do this particular, allowing women to do this, because it says that the actual argument in Roe v. Wade is that it serves the state's interest.
Well, that's
it serves the state interest to allow abortion to be legal.
Well, that's one of the reasons.
Right? So it's not about women, actually. No, it's not about freedom at all. It's about serving. They say that in the decision. Everyone should read that decision.
Well, there are some people that I've seen some arguments, even from people that are absolutely pro-abortion rights, that have said Roe v. Wade is a bad decision. It's just not a.
Oh yeah.
It's not a well. It has allowed all the crap that's gone on since Roe v. Wade is because it was not a really a very good, not a well-constructed decision.
They still have the legal right to do whatever they want with our bodies.
Right.
Whether that's stopping us from having abortions or, you know, forcing our bodies into airplanes into foreign countries to go kill brown people.
Right.
So the Swedish model, we haven't talked about this yet. Do this quickly. Did we do this?
Swedish model, basically.
What is it and why is it bad?
Swedish model is basically argues that, like I was making fun of earlier, that women basically cannot be trusted to make our own sexual decisions, that men are always in control. And so therefore, if a man waves money at a woman and she takes it to have sex, that's his fault. Because basically he has power to make a decision of good or evil, and she does not have that power.
So the purchaser is the criminal.
The purchaser is the criminal.
It does decriminalize the selling.
No.
That's what it claims to do.
That's what
right?
it claims to
okay.
do, but it doesn't actually
How's do that?
Because, when you still have a crime going on, mm-hmm. and so the sex worker is still an accessory to that. Even if she's not committing a crime herself, she's still helping someone else to commit a crime. She still has to be
so
the
one. So she could be prosecuted for that, for being an accessory. Okay.
If there's two sex workers working together, those countries still have brothel keeping laws. They still have pimping laws. So if two sex workers work together, they can be charged with pimping each other. If one of them keeps a place to work, she can be charged with brothel keeping. If she has an in-call, if she has a place that guys come to see her, she can be charged with brothel keeping. She, in some of the regimes, like Canada comes to mind, which it recently adopted a Swedish model regime, she can be prosecuted for taking out an ad, because taking out an ad is illegal. Hmm. And then, of course, there are all the things that kind of go back to the safe harbor thing I was talking about earlier. When you say, this is not a crime, you're still not saying, you're not surrendering the state's control. There was a case where a Swedish college student very vociferously, openly discussed her sex work with other students, and she was expelled. So she wasn't criminally prosecuted, no, but she was expelled from school. Her education was cut off, right? Because she was countering the state's party line. She was not allowed to do that. The most despicable, disgusting outgrowth of the Swedish model I can think of, the one that's the most obviously reprehensible to anybody, a couple of years ago, Norway, which also has the Swedish model, right, had something that was called, literally, the literal name for this police operation was Operation Homeless. And Operation Homeless, the Swedish police took all the names of sex workers that they knew were sex workers, right? And they went to their landlords and told them, do you realize you can be prosecuted under pimping laws by renting to her?
Ow.
So that massive numbers of them were evicted. But that's to protect women, right? Getting evicted is to protect them. Operation Homeless. They literally called it that. They didn't even try to disguise it. We're going to make you homeless.
It's like when they shut down the brothels in the early 20th century.
Yes.
Forced all the women onto the streets.
And of course, there was a Canadian politician who, when the harm of the Swedish model was shown to him during the process when Canada was thinking about adopting it, he goes, but we don't want to make prostitutes safer.
Right.
He actually said that on a microphone. We don't want to make prostitutes safer.
Right. So it doesn't technically criminalize the person selling sex. It
doesn't technically.
But it implicates him or her in all sorts of ways that can lead them to be homeless or imprisoned.
It's interesting to say him or her because It's always women.
Oh, the Swedish model is only applied to...
They like to pretend male sex workers don't exist because the whole rationale for the Swedish model is that you and I know several male sex workers.
Yeah,
of course we do. Yeah. And but the thing is, the model is pushed as a feminist thing, so they have to pretend that all buyers are male and all sellers are female. They must pretend that for the model to stand. And of course, I'm here to tell you, not only are not all sellers female, not all buyers are male.
Right. Well, I was just going to say
I have female clients.
I was just going to say, even if it technically does not criminalize the person selling sex, it does criminalize her means of making a living.
Yes.
So it makes it more difficult for her to make a living.
Yes. Right? It makes it more dangerous.
Which is another reason we're not so keen on it, are we? Feminists overwhelmingly, there may be a few exceptions that you're aware of. I haven't seen any really, but except for the libertarian weirdos that you mentioned, but you know, the standard left-wing feminists overwhelmingly love the Swedish model.
Oh, yes, they do.
Because they think it does take all the stigma off of the woman and all the legal onus off the woman and places it all on the man.
Yeah, Simon Hagström. So, yeah. Simon Hagström is a Swedish cop, now retired, who's making a living now, going around being a show pony for Swedish model proponents. This man I'm going to not make any bones about it, he's a pervert. He's a complete pervert. He wrote a book. In his book, he proudly displays pictures of himself sitting on other cops' shoulders to peek in sex workers' windows to catch them in the act. He literally goes around with a collection of used tampons and sanitary pads that he, quote, was evidence, close quote. I'm not sure evidence of what. Evidence that they were menstruating women? I'm not sure that that's criminal even under the Swedish model. But this man's a pervert, and so he's making his living doing this. And this is the kind of exploitation and state oppression that the Swedish model makes possible. And he's lionized for this.
Right.
By women.
Oh, yeah. Well, because they put a lot of men in prison. Right? And that's what's happened.
No.
Haven't they?
Actually, no.
Isn't that what the whole point is?
Yeah, but that's not what happens. What happens is they mostly get fined. I don't know that any men have actually gone to prison under the Swedish, or the number is very small.
They at least get publicly shamed, don't they?
They do often, get publicly shamed. Right. What happens in the United States, too.
A lot of men would prefer to go to prison than having their name in the paper. Right?
Or pay a fine.
I think the name in the paper is the greatest punishment that
absolutely.
They can mete out. Yeah.
No, absolutely.
You know, that's very common in the United States. That's when I really lose all of my... academic sort of detachment from the issue.
Yeah, I have no academic detachment.
Oh, I'm sure. As I said, for you, it's a question of being free or in a cage. So
yeah,
I get
absolutely.
That. But for me, even though I don't face that threat, it's just when people do that, when the state does that, when the state criminalizes people and punishes them and especially shames them for sex.
Yes. Because that's what
voluntary,
it is,
voluntary, consensual sex,
It's thought... The whole concept of prostitution is thought crime. Because if I go out and have sex with, I could walk out in the street right now and pick some guy and say, hey, dude, you want to come in here and fuck me? That's perfectly legal, right? As long as I don't do the actual act in public, right? Because then it would be an indecent exposure or whatever. But I can publicly hail him and say, hey, come on, as long as it's free. Mm-hmm. But if my motive is to make a profit, that motive is what's being criminalized.
So is the Swedish model is it threatening to be passed in any of the states at this point?
In the United States?
Yeah.
No, because what would have to happen is they would have to even have a semblance of the Swedish model, they would have to decriminalize the seller, at least on paper, mm-hmm. and that's not going to happen.
Well, I think it could happen. I think it could happen in a state like California.
No. Hell no. Ain't going to happen.
Because feminists are very powerful in California.
If it happens, I will buy you dinner. I am not going to lose this bet, though.
Well, I don't want it to happen. So
But I'm just saying, though, it ain't going to happen.
So what are the prospects? I mean, for what do you think is going to happen in the next 10, 20, 30 years in the United States, legally?
What I think is going to happen is, we had Lawrence versus Texas, right? This is the thing. If you look at sexual rights in the United States, they never, never happen on a national level by anything but a Supreme Court decision. And so we have Eisenstadt versus Baird. We have Virginia versus Loving. We have Roe versus Wade. We have Lawrence versus Texas. We have, what's the one, the recent one, that legalizing same-sex marriage. I can never think what the name of that one is. But it'll get in my head eventually. But the point is, all these things, right? They always happen by a Supreme Court decision. They always happen by judicial fiat. And so what I'm picturing is that in 10, 15 years, something like that, we're going to have a Supreme Court decision that's going to decriminalize. And then it's going to be like Roe v. Wade. What's going to happen is the Supreme Court's going to say, you can no longer criminalize the actual exchange of money for sex. And states are then going to run around going, oh yeah. And some states are going to adopt the Nevada model. And some states are going to adopt something like the old British model, where the actual sale of sex is legal, but brothel keeping is not, and pimping is not, and soliciting is not. And some states are going to adopt the Swedish model, and some states are going to come up with a convoluted thing of their own. And maybe one or two states, maybe like New Hampshire, for example, may decide to come, yeah, you know what? Let's just roll with decrim. Let's try it. One or two states may do that. But like I said, I think that's what I foresee as being the next 50 years or so, is decriminalization on paper, you know, by judicial fiat, followed by a generation of states trying to undermine that, just like they've tried to undermine Roe v. Wade. Okay, we can't criminalize abortion, but we're going to make these, it's so hard for you to open an abortion clinic that it might as well be criminalized. Same kind of thing, right? We're going to make it so hard for you to actually do sex work, you might as well be a criminal. That's what I foresee.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would imagine some states will be better others, and some states, in some states it might actually stick, like Roe v. Wade. I mean, you know,
right.
In California, it's still pretty easy to get an abortion.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so let's talk briefly about where you come from, who you are,
my history, my
and then that'll do it. But yeah, so I mean, you know, this kind of ties in actually to a lot of what we've been saying, which is that, you know, this question is often asked of sex workers, you know, well, what happened to you? Why are you doing this?
Catholic background.
There must be something. What happened? What did your dad do to you? What did your mom do to you?
Nothing.
What kind of drug addict, alcoholic, penniless, vagrant person were you?
I was raised what I would consider middle class. I mean, not upper middle class, not lower middle class, just really straight down the middle class. Mm-hmm. We probably would have had a higher standard of living if my parents had not been huge believers in Catholic education, which means five kids. I was the oldest. All my mom's salary pretty much went to school, to schooling for us.
And where was this?
In Louisiana.
Where?
Suburban New Orleans.
Okay. You don't want
to. I grew up in the River Parishes.
More specific?
Okay.
The River Parishes.
The River Parishes.
Good enough.
It's as general. That's as specific as I'll get.
Good enough. Okay.
Heavily Catholic area, right? Mostly people with high school educations, right? My mother was very uncomfortable with the topic of sex, and so I never got positive or negative messages about sex in my home. I never got anything. If I asked a question that was sexually tinged, my mother would say something like, oh, go look that up. Or, well, you know the answer to that, or something like that. So I never got heaped with the sexual shame, because my mother wasn't willing to talk about sex at all, even to heap shame. And that may be part of why I'm more sexually open-minded, right? Because I was left my own devices to develop my own attitudes about it. My relationship with my father, I mean, that's the common one, right? That, you know, daddy issues, as they like to say. My dad and I were never close, but I wouldn't say I had issues. I mean, I didn't fear him. He didn't molest me.
So you're not selling sex to regain your father's love?
Oh, God, no. No, I'm selling sex to make money. No, no. I mean, no. And I also, that's kind of bizarre. I mean, I know a lot of sex workers, and some of them speak well of their dads, and some of them don't, and pretty much like any other women, really. It's kind of infantilizing, isn't it? You know, the idea that a woman again, could only make a pragmatic decision because...
Of course, that's the
point. Because daddy didn't love her.
That's the point.
So there was that. I was very precocious.
Yeah.
I was sexually precocious as well as, you know, intellectually precocious, right? So, I mean, I was...
Yeah, so where did the intellect come from? Where did the interest and ideas come from? The reading and the books and the ideas and all that. The big ideas. Was that...
Where do those things come from? I mean,
well,
for me, it's
obvious because both my parents were intellectuals.
No, my parents weren't intellectuals. Yeah. They had that thing that you see in some cultures where education is very important, and you're going to be more educated than we were. So I was Catholic education was paid for me all the way through 12th grade. I was sent to a very good school, and then, of course, it was assumed I was going to go to college.
There are a lot of excellent Catholic intellectuals.
Well, I mean, there's a strong tradition among Catholics, like among Jews, right?
Oh, yeah.
That learning is very important.
Yeah.
That schooling is very important.
They have weird ideas about God, but otherwise, I know many, many brilliant, brilliant intellectuals who are practicing Catholics.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant. And they're... No, I'm not going to get into that. but the
huh? Well, okay.
Okay. I'm just going to say that I have noticed, and I have talked to some friends of mine who are kinky about this, and we have noticed that it seems that a disproportionate number of kinky people were raised Catholic.
Oh yeah. Well, that's like an old stereotype.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure why that should be, unless it's all that iconography of the whipping and the crowning with thorns and the, you know, I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I've always thought that the thing with Catholics is that they are repressive, but in a way that's ineffective. So they're sort of the medieval repression model, which is that it's all external. We're going to punish you. We're going to hit you, whip you, you know, throw you in the dungeon for doing these bad things, or in the home, you know, we're gonna hit you in the head if you touch yourself, which of course they found out in the modern age isn't very effective, doesn't stop people from doing those things. In fact, it encourages it,
right?
Those activities. So Protestants figured this out, and they said, oh, instead of like hitting you and punishing you physically, we're gonna shame you. We're gonna teach you to believe that it's a bad thing to touch yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, and because that's of course, way more effective.
When in Catholic thought, of course, there's always confession, right?
Yeah.
You no matter what sin you commit, you can go to confession and you can confess it, and the priest can absolve that sin. And that, I think, keeps Catholics from developing that. I mean, we talk about Catholic guilt, but I think Protestants have really...
They perfected it.
Way better.
No, I just think they perfected it.
Guilt.
They perfected
it. Yeah. Catholics did.
Catholics gave it a good try, but they just didn't do it very well.
No.
Also,
no, I agree with that.
I also think it's a sensual religion. I mean, the institution, the Catholic Church itself, is a sensual church.
Well, Camille Paglia would agree with you.
As an institution, sure. I mean, I love going to Catholic churches. I mean, they're gorgeous.
And they're very pagan.
They drink wine.
Very pagan.
And they're all about you know, ostentation. I mean, it's...
Different saints, magic words.
Whereas you go to a Protestant
special garments.
Church, it's all very spare. And, you know, there's just one minister, and he wears maybe a business suit, and that's about it.
Yeah.
So... All right, so you are a whore because you're Catholic. We established
that. No, I didn't say that. I'm a very pragmatic person.
Those are potential influences. They may also have nothing to do with it.
I think it's potential. I think, like I said, I think my mother not giving me sexual messages one way or the other left me a lot more free to move, so to speak, sexually. I wasn't, right? The first time I was ever sexually shamed was by the lesbians I knew in college. They were the first people who really, you know, worked on sexually shaming me.
What did the mean lesbians do to you?
Well, I mean, things like, oh, this was in the 80s. So, I mean, it was things in the 80s like, real lesbians don't use strap-ons. Real lesbians don't fist each other. What are you talking about? You can't do that. Real lesbians are not kinky. Real lesbian, no woman would want to hit another woman.
So this is when you were playing around with girls, too?
Yes.
Okay. And they said you were doing it wrong.
Yes. They said I was doing it wrong. I was playing with girls wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting to, especially the kink.
You didn't read the lesbian
kink
textbook.
Kink shamed. Seriously. You are not supposed to do that. You want to do what to another girl?
Hmm.
Oh, no.
So where'd you go to college?
UNO, okay. University of New Orleans.
Okay. And you were an English major?
Yes. Graduated in 1987.
Okay.
And my I got my graduate degree from LSU in 93.
When you were in college, did you start to think of yourself as an intellectual?
I have never thought of myself as an intellectual.
Why? You are. It's just a lover of ideas. That's all it means.
I hate
the stigma attached to the word. And yeah, I'm trying to free it of that.
I know you are. And I also remember that when we did that Reason TV interview and you called me a public intellectual, I said something like, I don't recall what I said. So I'm going to pretend you didn't insult me just now or something like that.
Yeah, I hated that.
but I think to me, an intellectual, I guess in my mind, is somebody who gets their primary joy from intellectual things.
Okay.
from
guilty as charged. Okay.
And I don't. And so therefore, I'm not saying I don't enjoy intellectual.
You get a lot from it.
I do.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's my primary.
Okay.
I think the primary things I do to enjoy myself are not necessarily intellectual, unless I'm doing them with, even when I'm doing things that are intellectual, I'm getting a lot of feedback from the people I'm doing them with. So it's like if I like someone or love someone who enjoys intellectual stuff and we do those things together, mm-hmm. then...
So it's relational.
It's relational.
Right.
Rather than, you know... And I'm not saying I don't enjoy intellectual things because I certainly do. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying it's not overwhelmingly a motivator for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, but you have great intellectual confidence, I would say.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I also have great sexual confidence.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, in your public persona is much more intellectual than sexual. But anyway, regardless, whatever it is.
It's, you've never seen me drunk.
Well, I take that. There's a lot of both. There's a lot of both. But you do, I mean, you do have... extraordinary intellectual confidence.
Well, thank you.
Which is justified, but I mean that's rare. I mean, I'm just curious about where that came from because I didn't actually have that until I didn't really have it until my dissertation defense.
Okay, I can tell you where it came from. Actually,
okay.
I really can. I was a weird kid.
Here we go.
I was a very weird kid. I've called myself a little Wednesday Addams, and I was a weird, weird little kid, and. My parents didn't quite know how to deal with me, and that's not a boo-hoo-hoo, my parents don't understand me. That's, my parents were first-time parents. They were young. They were in their early 20s. They were not educated people. They didn't know how to deal with me. I was just this freaky little kid, you know? And so what they found they could relate to was my intellectual brilliance. They could praise me for that.
How were you weird? What was weird about you?
Oh my God. How long do we have? You know, I mean, seriously, I was a weird kid. I was very precocious. I said things, people, unconventional things. I used to have visions and stuff like that. Hmm. I actually had, you know, like clairvoyant visions and mm-hmm. things. And my mother blamed this on watching scary movies, which of course was nonsense, but that's, you know, because she couldn't understand it, she couldn't accept that. And so I was just, like I said, weird. But when I would perform well in school, I would get the strokes, right? I would get patted on the head. I'd get told how wonderful I was. And so the only thing that I could consistently get strokes, the only thing I could consistently get praise from, the only thing that I would consistently get reinforced for was intellectual brilliance. I mean, you want to psychoanalyze me.
I do.
Maybe one of the reasons I eventually turned to a sexual career was that, I've always been pragmatic about sex, always. I always used sex for whatever. So, like, I used sex as a means of socializing. I used sex as a means of getting intimacy. I used sex as a means of having fun in the sense of, like, bonding with a group. And yes, I do mean group sex. I used it as a means of being cool, you know, right? I used it as a way to say thank you. Oh, you helped me move. Here, have some sex. And so for me, it was very pragmatic from a fairly young age.
And transactional.
It was very right. transactional. Yeah. Yeah. And so it was not to me any kind of a big deal to get cash for it as opposed to, you know, it was always transactional to me. Hmm.
Yeah, and then after college, you chose typical career path for a future sex worker. you became a librarian.
Right. I know one other.
You scratch a sex worker, you'll find a librarian. Everyone knows that. Right?
It does work for my marketing now, though.
Oh, yeah.
It does.
Oh, no, it's great.
Like, I used to be a librarian, and guys are like, you did?
Oh, of course,
because really?
It's like probably a major porn subgenre.
Oh, you know? God, yeah. I mean, I have in my desk drawer a pair of cheaters. Because I don't need glasses, but I want a pair of cheaters so that when guys wanted a librarian fantasy, I could put the cheaters on and pull them down my nose. Because that's the thing, right? You have to look over the glasses, pull them down your nose.
So how long were you a librarian?
I was librarian from September of 1990 until January of 95 is when it kind of started falling apart for me. That was when my first husband left me, and I did not take it well. And that's putting it mildly. I didn't take it well at all. Mm-hmm. And so it became, within about 3 or 4 months, literally impossible for me to go to work. I simply couldn't go to work anymore. And even after I started being able to work again at all, I couldn't do the 9-to-5 thing. I just couldn't. And I needed to make a lot of money. I had a huge amount of debts because my ex left me with tons of debts in my name. On a librarian's salary, and I couldn't even do library anymore, right? So I needed to make a lot of money. And I needed to make a lot of money in a way that didn't require me being at work every single day, whether I was having an anxiety attack or not, because I had a lot of anxiety attacks in those days. And so I needed a job where I could go in if I was feeling good and say, no, I'm feeling good today, I can do this. And I needed a job where if I started feeling bad, I could say, I'm going to go home. And I wouldn't make money, but I wouldn't get docked either. And it wouldn't be a demerit or something like that, you know, which, I mean, right? We all know because in a standard 9-to-5 corporate type job, that's all being tracked, right?
It's a job with as much autonomy as a person can have,
yes.
Maybe, right?
Yes.
In a job,
and
which
this is one of the
exactly
reasons
the
so
opposite
many.
Of what,
oh, yeah.
How it's portrayed, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is why so many sex workers are mothers. Something like 70% of sex workers worldwide have children, right? Even though we have this Madonna whore thing, which pretends the opposite, which pretends that mothers and whores are the opposite. That's not true. When I had my agency, the majority of the women who worked for me had children. Right? And many of them became sex workers specifically for their children.
But, okay, so, but like, how did it actually happen? I mean, did you know someone? I mean, did you just start doing it? I mean,
Very first time I ever took money for sex was about 2 months past my 18th birthday.
Oh, so you started before you were a librarian?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought
it
all.
Up.
Okay.
I gave it up. Well, what happened? I'll try to make it quick. Basically, I was house sitting. For a friend of a friend who's an older man, who's a professor at Tulane, not at UNO.
Oh,
not
really?
One of my professors. Mm,
which field?
Engineering.
Okay. I don't care then.
And basically his wife wasn't around and he made a pass at me, and the house sitting gig due to circumstances had ended 2 days early, and I was getting $50 a day for doing the house sitting. And I was thinking of, where's that extra $100 going to come from? And he started making a pass at me, and I said, can I stay on the clock? And he goes, yeah. So I got paid my whole week of house sitting, $350, instead of the $250 I would have made because the gig ended early. So I made $100 in half an hour. And in 1985, that was a lot of money for a broke college student.
Sure.
And I was like, hell yeah. And so then I started, I didn't advertise, you know, I didn't take out ads or anything. It was just kind of a word of mouth thing. Like, guys that wanted to fuck me just got to know by word of mouth that if you're going to fuck Maggie, you need to give her something. And the amount was just kind of like, it was just sort of, I was very unprofessional. Mm-hmm. And I've said, if I could talk to my 18-year-old self, what I would say would be, charge for it, stupid. Mm-hmm. Because I just would be like, oh, $50? Okay, that's okay. Okay, $30? That's okay. $70? That's okay. You know what I'm saying? Whatever they would give me, as long as there was money. I did that for about 2 years. And then I very stupidly accepted a marriage proposal at 20. And
yeah, don't do that.
That was dumb. It was really stupid. So yeah. So and then I became a librarian. I went through all that. Da 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 da. Mm-hmm. And then so I didn't go back into it until 1997. So 87 to 97. And even then, I became a stripper because, right, I was still thinking in terms of my social network had fragmented. I didn't have all the ready guys. I kind of was still not ready to take that plunge of taking out an ad yet, right? And so I went ahead and did the kind of sex work light, right? Mm-hmm. I did the stripping.
The semi-legitimate.
Semi-legitimate. Work. And of course, I was there's a lot of strippers that hate what they call extras girls, girls who will do extra stuff in the champagne room for money. And yes, I was an extras girl. So any you strippers out there, you don't like me, that's, you know, there you go. Because I was indeed an extras girl. And then what happened was I got to be very close friends with a woman who's older than me, about 8 years older than me, my very, very dear friend. I call her Grace on the blog. And she had done stripping. She had done fetish modeling. She had done escorting. And she told me one day when I was bitching about the club, you really just need to be an escort. And I'm like, you think? And she's like, yeah, yeah, you'd be really good at it. And I'm like, okay. And so on January 2nd of 2000, I called an escort service and started working for them the same day, and I've never looked back.
But you also became a madam.
Yes.
When was that?
About 4 months in.
Oh, right away.
I hated the way that the woman that I was working for was running things. She was exploitative, I found. So I called around. I got some references to other services that were not anything like that. They were much, you know, nicer, much better run. But I also wanted to start my own, and so I did. I had the money. I started it.
And how many women were working for you?
It varied. Mm-hmm. It completely varied. That kind of thing, you a lot of escort services will say, oh, we have X number of people. That's bullshit.
Did you have a house?
It comes and goes.
A brothel?
No.
Or was it, okay, you
no.
just had them go to hotels?
Outcall. Outcall. Yeah. In New Orleans, that outcall is very big. Mm-hmm. Right, because sure. everybody's in a hotel room.
Right, tourists. Right? Yeah,
it's all tourists. So yeah, it was all outcall, and then I retired for a little while in 2006, but I was back doing it by 2010.
That's when we first right? sort of met each other. Yeah.
I just had started working again when I wrote to you that first time. Oh. I probably had been working again for like a few weeks.
And you had the blog then,
mm-hmm.
right?
And that's one of the reasons I went back to work. Actually, was because when I was starting to write the blog. And I know you're going to say I call myself not an intellectual. I felt writing the blog. I'm like, no, I need to put myself back into this mental space. I need to start working again. It's going to give me ideas for columns. It's going to give me a little extra pocket money, right? Which is always nice. And it's also going to make me, I also felt ethically, that if I was going to be speaking about sex work, and speaking as a sex worker, that I needed to be a freaking sex worker again. And slowly and for a while, right, I was calling myself a former sex worker. I was not letting on. I was working under a different name than I was advertising under. I mean, than I was being Megan McNeil under. and so eventually I just started feeling, no, you know what? I need to be more out. And so I started hinting a lot more. I wrote a column called Of Course I Would, where I said, if the need arose, people ask me, if the need arose, would you ever go back to it? I'm like, hell yes, I would. And of course, I had been back for several years mm-hmm. at this point. But I was kind of hinting, yes, of course. And then in 2015, I really just came out and said, no, I'm working again.
Very publicly.
Very publicly.
On TV.
Yes.
Right.
And it's funny because people often ask, has your being so out affected your business? And the answer is, yeah, it does. Both ways. It's weird. On the one hand, I have guys that specifically email me because I'm well known and famous. And they're like, oh, I want to see her because, right, some guys are star fuckers. Right, I want to fuck Maggie McNeil because she is famous, mm-hmm. And some because they feel they know I'm not a cop. So for some, it's a practical thing, right? She definitely ain't a cop. Some because they're more sensitive kind of guys, and I don't mean that I'm not using that as a euphemism. I just mean that they read my stuff and they go, she gets men. I think, yeah, you know, I can groove with her. So on that sense, it has made me business. But there's also guys that are more skittish, that absolutely won't see me because I'm so out. That are like, no, hell no. You know, because they feel uncomfortable. They feel, and I've had guys that are kind of on the fence that will see me in call, but they will not see me. They will not take me to dinner. They will not do anything like that because it's like, yeah, I'll come to your house and fuck you where nobody can see, but I'm not going to be seen in public because what if somebody sees us together and realizes, hey, wait a minute, that's that prostitute chick. And for a while after I was on TV, I did get that. I did have people coming up to me going, I saw you on TV. And I would go, yes, you did.
Well, hopefully that'll be more and more common that
I hope
clients
so.
Have to accept that the sex worker they're hiring is has been on TV.
Yeah.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. Our theme music was composed by Clint Partee, and our sound engineer is Gabriel Montgomery. If you have any questions you'd like me to answer on the podcast, post them to me at my Twitter handle, @ThaddeusRussell. Also, be sure to check out notes and links for each episode at ThaddeusRussell.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.